Tonight, there is an execution in Huntsville. And as always, KPFT is fulfilling its obligation to its listening audience by broadcasting a Texas Execution Watch. I'm Ray Hill. The staff tonight is Otis McClay doing chief engineering and other important duties, and Elizabeth Stein being the major producer of this show. We agreed to do this show each time Texas killed someone because we were of the opinion here at KPFT that far too much attention is given to the unique and horrible phenomena of executing people in Texas. The exercise of the awesome power of government against a single individual is going on tonight. Right now, Derek Saunier is in the death chamber in Huntsville. As this program progresses, we will receive reports from Gloria Ruback, our reporter in Huntsville, and we're going to go to London and talk to Piers Bannister about the work that's being done by Amnesty International around the issue of execution and what the world thinks of Texas and the United States for continuing that horrible practice. We are here now, and we will be here again. We were here just early in June for Derek Saunier. Derek Saunier was scheduled to be executed, the first of many scheduled executions after the Supreme Court decision that dealt with the efficacy or whether or not the lethal injection method of execution was cruel and unusual. The Supreme Court handed down a divided opinion that they felt that it was not, if it was given appropriate judicial review. Early in June, Derek Saunier was scheduled to be executed, but when he was literally in the death chamber awaiting that, he got a last-minute stay. I want you to think a minute about the gruesome experience of going through the ritual that you go through. Now, if someone's going to be executed in Texas, at least a month beforehand, they go to a court where a judge sets an execution date. And then that progresses so that there are some immediate appeals and secondary appeals that go through the court, and then the writs go, and then there is an application for clemency, and all of this is going on in process. Within a few days of the execution, the person is moved from death row at the Polunsky unit in Navasota and shipped to walled unit where the execution chamber is. The media is alerted. Invitations are sent out to the victims or victim survivors so they can come see the execution. The defendant's family, if any, is invited to Huntsville to see the execution. And then they start keeping these bizarre logs. What did the person have for breakfast 2 days before, and how much did they eat, and all of these records are kept, and what was the request for the last meal, and how was that provided? It is just a ritualistic, steady kind of countdown to the execution of the person. Derek Saunier went through this in early June, and then suddenly, at the last minute, they said, oh, not this time. And so he was shipped out of the death chamber, put in a van, carried back toward Polunsky. They got about halfway from Polunsky. They stopped. There was some conversation on the cell phone. They turned the van around and headed back for Huntsville. They got all the way back to Huntsville. They got to the back gate because somebody thought they were going to continue with the execution. And then word came, no, this is not happening. So before he even got out of the van, they carried him all the way back to Polunsky, where he is unloaded and waited for exactly the same ritual to happen tonight. I am joined by Elizabeth Stein.
Hey, Ray. Ray, I just spoke with Gloria Ruback, our reporter in Huntsville.
Yes.
About 5 minutes ago. She said she was expecting them to walk the witnesses across the street pretty soon to the death chamber. And she said there's about a dozen protesters there holding signs and the usual. She said the signs say things like stop state murder, abolition now, And why do we kill people who kill people to show that killing people is wrong? And she said someone from the Department of the Inspector General was trying to get her to move from a spot where she usually stands, and that she asked them to get the police if they in fact wanted her to move. And so that's still going on as far as I know.
As long has been the rules that if you're going to be a demonstrator up there, you must occupy City of Huntsville land, and that's the streets and the sidewalks. But they're doing that. They've always done that.
Right. She said she's been occupying that spot for a while. But that's a sideshow.
TDCJ doesn't have any control over that, so Gloria is right standing up for
okay.
Right.
Well, she said there's people there outside the death chamber from Commerce, Huntsville, Spring, Houston, and Conroe, et cetera. Protesting the execution.
Execution. And you're listening to radio station KPFT HD2 channel. That is Elizabeth Stein with the most recent update. We went to the somewhat difficult opportunity to get in touch with Piers Bannister. Piers is the point man on executions for Amnesty International. He is located tonight in London. Piers, how did you get involved in this execution business in the first place? They tell me that you are identified as a researcher for Amnesty International.
I kind of hold an overview for the organization, so I help them direct or organize their work on the death penalty worldwide. But I used to be the researcher on the death penalty in the USA.
Oh, really?
So, for instance, I've visited LSU Unit 1 in about 98, I think it was.
Well, LSU is a place close to where they used to do a great deal of execution. That has all moved to Texas now. Yeah. And tell me, how did you originally get interested in executions?
I can first remember being interested in the death penalty when I argued with my brother about it. And at that point, I was a 15, 16-year-old, I was a fervent supporter. But my brother educated me to the realities of capital punishment, how it's inflicted upon people who are suffering from mental illness or mental health problems, how it's often used against minorities in different countries all over the world. And slowly I sort of came round to the view that it wasn't used in a correct way. And that journey started me off on a very long journey, and now it wouldn't matter to me how the death penalty was used. It's as simple as this. Government should not be in the business of killing their citizens.
Well, as I was reading the material that they gave me in preparation for this discussion, you make a great deal to do of the inaccuracy of eyewitness testimony and the importance of it in death penalty cases.
Yes, that's correct. And one of the things that I'm working on at the moment is a worldwide study of innocence and the death penalty. And so I'm sitting at my desk day in, day out, writing about this subject, and I become more and more horrified at how easily some people are put to death around the world, including in the United States, on evidence that is completely unreliable. And I've no doubt at all that innocent people have been put to death in the USA. Of course, that's something the authorities have never admitted, unlike countries like the United Kingdom, South Korea, Russia, and other countries who have admitted they've made mistakes and exonerated people after their executions. And one of the things you often see in that is evidence given in good faith by people who believe that they've correctly identified an offender, but have quite simply made a mistake, as any human being can. So witness identification evidence is often very good evidence, but needs to be tested and is often wrong.
And frequently in cases, the eyewitness testimony is taken whole cloth and the absence of other evidence is not a controlling factor.
That's right. I can remember a case I worked on in the United States. Well, it's a woman I met, and she'd been brutally raped. And she told her jury that while she was raped, she stared at the man's face and memorized it. And she said that that was the man sitting in the dock there, and that man was duly convicted and given a long sentence. And the jury must have found that incredibly powerful evidence. And the woman gave it in absolute good faith. And later DNA tests proved that actually it was another man who had raped her. And the two did look similar. She had simply made an honest mistake. And to her credit, she then went around the country lecturing in the United States saying, you must have more than identification evidence. I truly believe that man was guilty of my rape. I put an innocent man accidentally into prison. I ruined his life. I'm sorry. It mustn't be allowed to happen again.
Well, once in a while, we will get a revelation on this side of the Atlantic. The governor of, was it Ohio, that had a look at the death penalty cases there? Or was that Illinois?
It's happened. It could be a number of states. It's happened in Illinois, which, of course, is the famous one,
yeah,
where Governor Ryan commuted all death sentences about 7 or 8 years ago.
And he did so because he was absolutely convinced that the large number of innocence findings made the whole system unreliable.
That's quite correct, and that was a very brave move by Governor Ryan, but it was absolutely the right thing to do. We mustn't focus too much on innocence. Often the vast majority of people in prison in the United States are guilty. The vast majority of people on death row are guilty. So let's not remember that every execution is an affront to human dignity and a violation of the most basic of human rights, the right to life. But it's interesting. We've seen the debate. You know, I remember the debate when I was growing up in the United Kingdom, as we had to admit we'd executed several innocent people, and that was one of the reasons we abolished the death penalty in 1969. It's often a reason why many politicians around the world oppose the death penalty, and I think that message is starting to get through in the United States. People are uncomfortable with that risk that's always present of executing an innocent person, and I think that's one of the reasons we're starting to see a growing movement towards abolition in the United States. As, of course, illustrated by the abolition of the death penalty in New Jersey last December.
Well, you know, the whole business, cases that I am familiar with because I'm from Texas are Rendell Dell Adams, Clarence Brantley. Clarence always knew that he was innocent, but Randall Dale was in such an inebriate state that he wasn't sure of his innocence.
Yes, that's unfortunately not a unique case. It reminds me of Gary Gensler in Illinois, who turned out to be innocent. And he was completely inebriated when his mother and father were murdered. And because he had a history of drug addiction, the police simply assumed it was him and basically got a conviction. It turned out that actually a motorcycle gang had, in the area, had committed the murders, and he was duly released.
Well, you seem to be interested or concerned about police behavior in interrogations in these cases, and you indicate that you don't think they come to these witness stands with clean hands.
Well, you have to be very careful when talking about police officers. You know, I very much view a police officer, a good police officer, as a protector of human rights. He or she is protecting us from people who seek to do us harm. Protecting women from violence, people from burglary, people being robbed. So I'm always very careful when I'm talking about the police to acknowledge the strong work that many of them do in dangerous circumstances. But of course, like any profession, they have people who will abuse human rights, and this is something Amnesty International is very used to dealing with. And I've, yes, been absolutely horrified before when I've seen police officers who simply framed people, ignored evidence. A case I've been working on recently in Jamaica, where a man was accused of killing a police officer during a robbery, and he was duly convicted and sentenced to death, and the police had withheld from the court videotape inside the bank, he'd robbed the bank, that showed it wasn't him. And of course, once that videotape was released, it clearly showed that he wasn't the robber, he was duly released. That is a horrific act. That police officer knew he was sending an innocent man to his death, to the gallows. I don't know how he could live with himself at night. So you do see many examples in the United States, around the world, of police abuse that lead people, innocent men and women, to face the death penalty.
What about prosecutorial behavior? The withholding.
That's true.
Purposely withholding evidence that there were.
After prosecutors have ignored evidence that would exonerate them, or used the death penalty where really they shouldn't have been using it, where really it wasn't appropriate. Now, of course, Amnesty International would argue that it's never appropriate, but we've seen cases where prosecutors have used the death penalty because it's politically expedient. It will look good on their resumes when they come up for re-election. They want to give an appearance of being strong on crime, so they become very used to using the death penalty because it's a very simple soundbite. Dealing with criminality is an incredibly complex area, But of course, the public don't have time to look at it. We all have busy lives to study it, to actually realize what good policing and good prosecutorial conduct is. So saying you're for the death penalty is a very quick way of sounding like you're hard on crime. It actually is completely ineffective as a deterrent. Quite the opposite. I think it distracts from really good policing, from really good prosecutions. It stops people talking about what's really going to solve crime problems.
I frequently give lectures where I say it's relatively uncomplicated to be a law enforcement officer, a prosecutor in a non-democratic society. It is a great deal more complicated and important to consider outside principles if you're going to do the same work in a democratic society. But there are really not many democratic societies doing executions anymore, are there?
No, you're quite right. I mean, the executions are comparatively rare things. In China, you see many thousands of executions. But outside of China, they really are a rare event. Only in 2007, only 24 countries carried out executions. Only 60 countries retain the death penalty. 137 have abolished it in law or in practice. For instance, in the Americas, only the United States currently executes. In the Caribbean, in Central America, in South America, Canada, etc., no one is carrying out executions. The last execution in the Americas outside of the U.S. was 2003, done in Cuba. So you start to see how large swathes of the world, democratic and non-democratic, are free from executions. And the U.S. looks completely odd and increasingly isolated on that list when it finds itself in the company of countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, China, countries with appalling human rights records and using the death penalty. It's always, people are very often surprised to see the USA on that list.
Does the United States' persistence at continuing that enhance our image around the world?
Does it enhance their...
our image?
No, I don't think so, particularly not in Europe. I mean, there's a huge amount of affection for the United States in the world, including from myself. You know, I've lived there, I have many American friends. So I'm always very surprised a country that is famed for its hospitality, for its excellent constitution, for being very influential in the world, still thinks it's the answer in the dingy basements of its prisons to put people to death, to use this new wonderful scientific method of lethal injection, which somehow is supposedly to make this awful thing more humane. How they can see that as acceptable. I can remember when I was a young man in 1990 and I saw somebody in the Alabama Supreme Court stand up, a very intelligent, very articulate, very smartly dressed woman, stood up in front of the court and argued why somebody should be put to death. And I remember my reaction very clearly, because my reaction was to run over to her and say, stop, don't you realize you're going to get somebody killed? And with horror, I realized that was exactly her purpose. That's why she'd come to work that day, to try and get somebody killed. That doesn't seem to be a good idea for taxpayers' money to be used for that, for a society to be involved in killing. It sends a very bad message that killing is acceptable in certain circumstances to wider society. So I think America should abandon capital punishment. It would do a lot to see ending the world in capital punishment, because I've spoken to many other governments, and the first thing they say to me is the United States uses executions. They use the United States to justify their own executions. So the United States is an icon for the world. It is a world leader. It shouldn't be a world leader in executions.
Pierce Bannister of Amnesty International, thank you very much for joining our show.
You're very welcome.
As you were.
And from the Library of Congress, Alan Lomax's, or maybe his father's, recordings of Voices from Prisons. It's a normal thing on the prison show for us to hear sounds of people from prison or people talking to people in prison. And so I thought I'd add some of that tonight here on this report. If you're getting this by delayed broadcast, I want to thank KPFT.org and KPFTX.org for carrying them in their archives so that you can follow this. We hope to have a way to link that, the archive, to the Prison Show website so that you can hear these programs that way. Right now, HD radios are not overflowing the population, so we have no idea how many people are listening. But we're going to broadcast discussions about execution every time Texas does one here on KPFT. That's the sort of thing a Pacifica station might do. Pacifica was founded in the late 1940s by a group of pacifists in California who wanted to have voices that were not influenced by commercial sponsors and by government control. And so they created non-commercial media, and that has evolved into the chain of Pacifica stations and, of course, a great many other forms of alternative media. National Public Radio and all of those folks do it. Here we do it differently, and here we have a special responsibility when the issues are as egregious as execution and war and other approaches. I thought I'd do a little rundown about what it costs to execute someone. If you're going to have a trial, and all executions result from a trial, the court personnel for that trial is going to cost about $74,000. The jury panel alone is going to wind up costing $17,220. Not just the ones that get paid $6 a day, but the overall group that you have to pick through to come up with who is the juries. The two defense attorneys and expert witnesses and investigators for the defense are going to cost $112,400. And that is pretty standard stuff because the people who actually get accused of capital crimes are usually indigent, and the taxpayers have to pay for their adequate representation. Three prosecuting attorneys are going to cost about $38,000. The judge is going to run almost $24,000. And the total cost for that sort of thing is considerable. And I just lost my image. Gloria.
Yes.
Okay, what's going on?
Media witnesses just walked across the street, and Derek Saunier's witnesses are walking back into the into the administration building right now. So the execution has been carried out. Derek Saunier is dead, and life in Texas goes on.
And you didn't get arrested this time?
No. I told them to call the police, but they didn't do it. So I'm still standing here by the crime scene tape.
Gloria, what do you know about Derek's case?
Well, from what I don't know him. I've never met him, so I really only know what's been in the media. I don't think he has ever claimed innocence. I haven't read that. So I know that what he did was a terrible thing that took a life of a mother and a child. But I also know that his death isn't going to bring relief to the victim's family, and it's going to create another victim's family. So I don't know that there was anything particular about this execution that stands out. It wasn't a case of innocence. It wasn't a case of mental retardation or anything like that.
Derek had a lot of hesitance about presenting a defense because it would involve the testimony of some of his family, I recall. And it seemed as if he was not he was embarrassed by what had happened to the degree that he did not want to involve other members of his family and all, even in his defense, which brings to mind that there might be some mental problems here.
Well, it could be, and if he wasn't mentally ill when he went to death row, I think about 10 years ago, he certainly could be now just because of the conditions that are really horrific on death row. And there's very, very real mentally ill people on death row. So, I think, I'm not sure about that, Ray, because a lot of people are hesitant. Well, I think they feel shame because their families are pulled into this, and they're, families are totally innocent.
And frequently these families are poor people in desperate struggles just for survival.
Exactly, day-to-day survival.
And frequently, I think the last person they executed had horrific history of all the evidence was there of a lot of physical abuse by his parents.
Right.
So by the time you get to death row, life has not been kind.
No. No. You're correct. The majority of the people that are on death row never graduated from high school. I think it's something like 70-80% are involved with drug and alcohol abuse. And many were themselves abused by their families, physically, sexually, verbally, and so on. Well, all the gray shirts are coming out now, and the guys with their big cowboy hats.
So the process has happened.
It has happened.
Lori, how many of these cases have you been there for?
Well, I was trying to tell the dear gentleman that wanted me to move that I've been here at least 200 times, and I've only seen him twice, so does he know about the rules?
Yeah.
I'm sure there's been 408 executions, I'm sure, for half of them.
Gloria, I was telling this audience earlier that there is so many ritual aspects to execution.
Yes.
The transportation, the recording of meals, the recording of the last words, all of this seems to be so ritualistic. It's almost a religious ceremony kind of structure.
It's embedded in the culture of this prison system.
I'm
just watching a man who could have been the doctor that pronounced him dead, or I don't know who he is. But he just left in his pickup, and in the back of his pickup are two red, like, onion sacks filled with prisoners' property. And he's heading towards the hospitality house, so I'm imagining he's taking Derek Sonnier's property to his family. Yeah, he's turning right there at the hospitality house. He's taking the property to the family. And you know, the ritual, that is... Well, at least they're not at midnight anymore. That was added another dimension of the surreal to what goes on here. But it's a ritual from the time that they leave death row in Livingston until they get here, as far as the transportation in the van. And if you don't willingly go, then they haul you in your underwear and... They push the envelope all the way many, many times. The last meal that, you know, supposedly somebody out there wants to know what the guy who's going to be murdered ate.
Well, I mean, that's a part of the ritual. They have been recording that forever and ever. And, you know, and as a matter of fact, they do art shows where they prepare replicas of the last meals.
Exactly.
And then there are the last words, which are dutifully written down and recorded. But that's a ritual. I don't know how far back that goes. It certainly was true of the American West. I remember when hearing, reading the legend of whenever they executed Indian Joe, who was a friend of Billy the Kid's in Lincoln County, New Mexico, was executing a lot of people in those days. But they carried Indian Joe out to execute, and they said, "Injun, you got some last words?" And he said, "I thought we'd come out here for a hanging. I didn't know we'd come out here for a talking." and we laugh, except what is the ritual about? Is it an attempt at socially justifying what is happening? What is that?
I think it is, and I think that they like to talk about the last meal, they like to talk about the last words, they like to have the spiritual advisor who makes them comfortable and compliant, really, so that they walk to their own death instead of refusing to go and forcing the prisoner.
Not all do that willingly.
Pardon me?
Not all do that willingly.
Oh, hell no, they don't. No, some people refuse to walk. I mean, if they're, and I, you know, I think it's up to each person how they react, but I can imagine if it was me, I would be kicking and screaming. And it's also the ritual of the last statement. It's not always published, because if you name names of guards and officers and you name things they've done, that doesn't go on to their webpage. When Joseph Nickell was executed, he talked about a female guard. Oh, God, her name escapes me at the moment. But not only did he curse her out, he named the things that she had done to him. But his last words on the webpage
were not recorded.
Now, at his funeral, his mother said that Joseph's last words were, "They took me over here almost naked and in chains, and that reminds me of how my ancestors were brought here." He said, "I thought that was fitting that they stripped me of my clothes and chained me to bring me to my death." But that kind of stuff is what they want to hear about.
Well, there's a case coming out of San Antonio of actual innocence. Ruben, what's his name? Cantu?
Cantu, yeah.
Ruben Cantu is pretty much established now. That Reuben was an actually innocent person who was executed. And Reuben said, "I'm an 18-year-old kid and I'm being framed for this murder."
Right.
And,
exactly.
And so somehow those words were survived. And tomorrow there's going to be a news conference here in Houston where a survivor of a person already executed, his name's Johnson,
Lonnie E. Johnson.
Lonnie Johnson. And they're going to attempt to file charges and have inappropriate prosecutorial behavior on behalf of Chuck Rosenthal presented to a grand jury in Harris County.
I think that
if there is any payback for prosecutorial misbehavior and police misbehavior on these capital cases, I think that will suddenly cause people to think very seriously about at least following through their responsibilities with some sense of ethics.
Well, I think only if the grand jury does something about Chuck Rosenthal. Otherwise, it'll be a blip. And business will continue as usual with the DA's office, who routinely withholds evidence and routinely strikes black people from a black defendant's jury, and routinely has jailhouse snitches who they don't care if they're lying or not.
Well, actually, they're rewarded for lying because they offer them sweetheart deals on their own cases.
Of course.
In exchange for that sort of thing. But, you know, do you recall the struggle that I went through to get a prosecution for the officer that killed Fred Pies?
Yes, I do.
You remember that? And,
yes.
And so I it took me a year to get Kevin McCoy indicted for a misdemeanor. And then he was acquitted. And one of the reasons he was acquitted is, as you will recall, there were only a handful of us in that that courtroom. Otherwise, everybody else there was a uniformed police officer looking at the jury and rubbing their gun.
Right. The men in blue were there.
Yes, in large numbers, and they were armed in that courtroom and staring at that jury.
Did the same thing at the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans recently when a man named Powell had a hearing in the Fifth Circuit. It was his, besides his family and a few friends, the room was filled with uniformed police officers, armed.
Armed. And in a very intimidating fashion, the jury. At the same time, there are people who don't even get indicted for shooting people in the back.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, the case of Lonnie Johnson, I think, is so important because I hope that the charges against Rosenthal go to the same jury that exonerated Joe Horn, or no-billed Joe Horn, because in Lonnie Johnson's case, he was given a ride. He's African American. He was given a ride by two white kids, teenagers, who went the wrong way. And when he said, "Well, why did you turn around and go the wrong way? I thought you said you were going this way," they put a gun in his side and said, "This is the end of the road," and used the N word. They're done for. Well, after they beat him and kicked him and urinated on him, he got a gun away from the one guy that had a gun, and he shot him. Well, that was self-defense. Now, if you look at what Joe Horn did, he may have, and he didn't stay in the house like he was told to do, and he shot two people in the back, and they no-billed him. I wonder why Lonnie Johnson is dead, executed a year ago tomorrow, and Joe Horn is free to walk around. I think race has a large part of it, and that's the other thing. I mean, the death penalty has its rituals, but the death penalty also can be characterized by so much racism. And I think that's a key part of the whole question of capital punishment in this country.
Well, Gloria, you're a member of an organization that struggles politically against executions.
Yes.
Tell us about the organization and how people can get in touch with you.
Oh, okay. I'm with the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, and the abolition movement has been around since the mid-90s, I guess. We're based at Shade Community Center, and I can give an email, which is abolition.movement@hotmail.com. It's abolition.movement@hotmail.com, and I have a phone number also. It's 713-503-2633.
713-503-2633?
Correct.
Okay.
And we meet on the first Tuesday of the month, unless there's an exception. If I'm not mistaken, August 1st is on a Tuesday, and I believe there's an execution. So, and if I'm right about that, I don't have my date book in front of me. Meet on the Monday before.
And Gloria Rubach is also a voice one hears frequently on KPFT's The Prison Show.
Correct.
Thank you, Gloria.
Okay, and thank you, and Elizabeth and Otis and everybody that's worked on this show. I think it's really important that the listeners of KPFT have a chance to hear from us whenever somebody's being executed. And we've got six executions scheduled for next month, one of whom is Jeff Wood, who wasn't even in the place when somebody, unbeknownst to him, killed somebody. His case is very similar to Kenneth Foster's. And for those who are
The Wood case is one of those law party cases. But, you know, recently we had pretty good news on a law party case.
Yes.
The governor intervened and commuted the sentence so that the scheduled person to be executed lives to continue their case.
Well, he's in a regular general population prison,
sure.
And he's still appealing his case.
Yeah, he continues his case. I mean,
yes, exactly. Yeah.
But the thing about it is, when someone is executed, that's the end of the line.
Exactly. And that's happened to many people.
Under the law of parties.
Right. That happened to Joseph Nichols, that happened to James Bethard, it happened to Carlos Santana. In fact, that's one of the things we're working on, because that's one of the things we're going to lobby the legislature next session that begins in January, is getting rid of the law of parties. It's not fair. Texas is the only, many states have a law of parties, but Texas is the only state that will execute somebody under the law of parties, and that's got to stop. That's ridiculous. And you know what's weird? In Joseph Nichols' case, when they first tried him, Joe had left a deli that he and another guy had tried to rob. And Joe was leaving, gone. Unbeknownst to him, his fall partner went back in and killed somebody. Well, when they first tried Joe, they tried him under the law of parties, and the jury convicted him but wouldn't sentence him to death, so it became a mistrial. They felt like he hadn't pulled a trigger, he wasn't there. The other guy admitted to the one bullet that killed the guy, Willie Williams, but they wouldn't send Joe to death row. So when they retried him, the Harris County DA put the gun in his hand, and he fired the one shot that killed the man.
Even though there was evidence was to the contrary.
Well, even though the shooter had confessed, had already been tried, and had already been sent to death row. This is the kind of stuff that Harris County shouldn't be allowed to get away with. But Joseph Nichols is dead now and can't continue to fight his case.
So. Gloria Ruback, I look forward to seeing you in the studio for the prison show.
Okay, see you Friday night. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. We have with us on the air Professor Marvin Zellman, who is the criminal, CRJ department? Criminal Justice Department at Wayne State University in Detroit. Professor Zellman, we just killed a man in Texas a few minutes ago, and I've read some of your articles for the Justice Quarterly about the innocence and actually innocent people. Is that the only issue in execution?
No, of course not. The issue of wrongful convictions has become much more prominent in the last few years, largely because of DNA testing. And there's strong evidence, not by work that I've done, but work by Frank Baumgartner at Penn State University and others, that indicate that the DNA exonerations have changed the opinions of a lot of people in the U.S. about the death penalty.
Well, I mean, we had the governor of Illinois doing some pretty heavy politically things. I mean,
former Governor Ryan of Illinois was shocked to discover in the year 2000 that Illinois had exonerated more people from death row than had been executed in the 1990s. And as a result of that, he issued a moratorium and got a commission to study the death penalty process. They did so. They issued a lot of recommendations, some of which were enacted into law. And before he stepped down from office in 2003, he exonerated four people on the grounds of actual innocence who were on death row, and he commuted the sentence of all others. I think it was over 150.
Yeah, I mean, and prior to doing that, Governor Ryan was not noted for being a bleeding heart liberal political.
He was a Republican who was in favor of the death penalty.
Earlier in the show, we had a conversation with Piers Bannister from Amnesty International in London. And he talked about the United States being so unique in executions. But it's worse than that. We seem to be on a rush to executions.
Yeah. Congress passed and President Clinton signed a law in 1996 called it's called AEDPA, Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act. And it was designed to cut back in a variety of ways on prisoners' ability to bring federal habeas corpus suits and basically to speed up the timetable of execution. The irony of that is that by 1996, people were beginning to get an inkling that there are many more errors in the criminal justice system leading to the conviction of innocent people than we had ever suspected before. So there were different trends, but yeah, that's true.
I'm sitting in Texas, of course, and we're the execution capital of the so-called democratic society world. And Dallas has now had 18 exonerations based on DNA. Not all of them were death row cases, but these are people who were either scheduled to die or were sentenced to prison who were totally innocent and have been exonerated. There's a very fine play out called Exonerated, which Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon parading around the country so that folks will think about these issues. What sociologically, do you think there's actually a change or could be a change of the political commitment to executions?
Well, it may not seem that way moments after an execution has taken place in Texas. But in fact, a study by Professor Baumgartner at Penn State, I think, shows very strongly with sort of statistical evidence that in the United States since 2000, there's been a sharp decline in public support for the death penalty. But more importantly, fewer juries have convicted people on the death charges. So there actually has been a decline in recent years. So I think that there's much rethinking about the issue on the grounds of the issue of the death penalty on the grounds of innocence as opposed to the older, I think still valid arguments about the morality of the death penalty and its deterrent effect.
Well, whenever Texas prepares a jury for a capital trial, you pretty much the only people that actually make it to the jury booth up there are those that are predestined to favor the death penalty. Isn't
that? Yeah, that's right. The Supreme Court said way back in the either late 60s or very early 70s that jurors who said that they could never bring in a death penalty could not sit on the jury. And there's a certain sense to that. The only way, I think, to have a totally fair jury would be to have two juries, to pick one that decides guilt or innocence, and that would be a normally selected jury. And then if a person were found guilty, then to select the second jury that would then be so, the term they used is scruple. They don't have scruples against the death penalty. That would be wildly expensive, and, it would require two full trials, over an individual, and, You know, we calculate a lot of things in this society. You know, we know that a certain number of miles driven on the highways are going to lead to death, and we may get more fair jury trials and death penalty cases if we had two trials, but no state has even thought about going to the expense of doing that.
There are, however, jurisdictions which have death penalty permissive laws that are not actually killing anyone.
Yeah, that's really one of the most curious factors about the death penalty in the United States. To the extent that it's actually used, it's used in a handful of states. Texas, Florida, and Virginia have been leaders. Florida has had some rethinking about it, and there's been a drop there. Ohio has executed a fair number of people in a few years, but it's more or less a southern phenomenon, suggesting that there may be cultural roots to the actual use of the death penalty. And most of the states which don't have the death penalty, such as Michigan, tend to be in the northeast or north central states.
The two other guests we've had on the program and I have been discussing about the very ritualistic nature of the way a death penalty is actually carried out. You have any idea what that's about?
Well, I could speculate, but I'm not really an expert on that. I know there's the justice system is very solemn. Certainly in the courtroom, there's a certain level of formality and solemnity. And speculating about the
I would hope that the very issue of liberty would be a solemn occasion. People think about that in a solemn way, and certainly the matter of considering life and death should be solemn. But the actual process of execution takes on almost cartoon-like quality in a ritual.
Well,
I mean, the last
word. I'm not sure that I could comment on that. You mentioned liberty.
Yeah.
My research is very much concerned with accuracy, and the question as to how accurate our entire criminal justice system is. And I think what's been shown by this movement towards exonerating people who are in prison, not only for the death penalty, suggests that. I can't go into all of the evidence for this.
Sure.
But I would support the notion that there may be an error rate in felony convictions in the U.S. of about 1%. That would suggest 10,000 people convicted in the courts of felonies every year who were innocent. And of those 10,000, 4,000 being sentenced to prison.
Well, in reading and preparing for my discussion with you, there was some information about the reliability of eyewitnesses.
It's very shaky. You had an execution in Texas around 2000, towards the end of the term that President Bush served as governor of Texas. I believe the man's name was Gary Graham.
Mm-hmm.
He was executed basically on the testimony of one eyewitness who saw a man running out of a convenience store. She was sitting in a car, and that's pretty shaky, just if that's the only evidence, just to convict the person, but to execute him seems pretty wild. Eyewitness error is the leading cause of wrongful conviction, and there are lots of reasons for it. The process could probably be improved, and I think police are beginning to change the way in which they conduct lineups, but it's very unnerving.
And not too awful long ago, I had a guest on my regular prison show from Williams College, Massachusetts, who was done some research in people who wrongfully confess to crimes.
Yeah, that would be Saul Kassin. I'm familiar with his work. Something like 20% of all exoneration cases, in about 20% of all of those cases, there's a false confession. People are under a lot of pressure when they're interrogated by the police. And the police, when they interrogate somebody, aren't really trying to determine the truth. They make up their mind in advance, and sometimes they're mistaken. But the pressure is so intense that a lot of people just buckle under the pressure. especially if interrogation goes beyond 2 hours. It can become relentless. People feel that they're trapped and will often finally admit under the pressure that, I did it, hoping that they can then prove it later on. But once they say that and it's recorded, it tends to be then treated as the truth, and it's very hard for a jury to put that aside if they hear about it.
Then the old saw that if you kill somebody, you deserve to be killed. Relatively few homicides actually result in executions, isn't that correct?
Very small percentage, yeah. I don't have the figures at my fingertip, but it's very small. I suspect that that's true, you know, even within a state like Texas with an active death penalty regime. If you looked at the whole of the U.S., it would be minuscule.
And you get a handle on why that's true? I mean, is it that we really don't have that ethic in our society, and so we just kind of random pick cases and go with it? Or,
well, part of the issue is legal. When the Supreme Court, as you know, declared the death penalty as administered unconstitutional in 1972, then when the states reenacted death penalty laws in the 1970s, the Supreme Court upheld them if they allow for guided discretion. So the automatic imposition of the death penalty for any homicide is not constitutional. Therefore, a jury has to, and I assume that they take their responsibilities carefully. You know, they'll have to look at the aggravating factors, weigh them against mitigating factors, and come to a judgment as to whether or not the particular homicide for which a person had already been convicted was so bad that it deserved the death penalty as opposed to life imprisonment. So jurors, are given the job of trying to sort out the worst cases of homicide from others. And, I'm willing to accept that almost all juries take that responsibility very seriously, and that would be one major reason why there aren't that many death sentences. And among those, there's another factor to be taken into account. A very good study done that was published in 2000 showed that about two-thirds of all death sentences were overturned by appellate courts on the basis of serious error that would cast doubt on the accuracy of the verdict, which suggests that certainly up to 2000, the trials that led to executions.
Professor Feldman, I'm afraid that all the time we have, and radio clock is gone. Professor Marvin Zalman, the Criminal Justice Department of Wayne State University. Is there a website where people can see your work?
If they Google Wayne State University, I should be in there under the Criminal Justice Department.
And your articles will be attached there, too.
References to some fool. My most recent article, you can't see the whole article for another 18 months.
Thank you, Professor. We appreciate you.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. And so we... KPFT is able to stay commercial-free because listeners like you make a pledge of support to keep us on the air. Thanks to the fine work of Elizabeth Stein and the expert work of Otis McClay. We brought you Death Row Texas Execution Watch. We'll be back the next time we kill somebody or plan on it. Hopefully we'll have a better news that time. Tonight, Derek Saunier was killed by the awesome pound.